Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Welcome to episode 43, Unforgotten Talk, season one, Ender.
Ender reminds me of like the Foo Fighters song, Pretender.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but that's what that was immediately what started playing in my head.
That's what went into your head. I was thinking, yep. What is it? Not End Games.
Game of Thrones.
What's that?
Ready
no,
Player One?
It's yeah. Well, it's kind of like that. Yeah, but isn't there a guy? Isn't it the guy named Ender or something like that? Or the name? Oh, I don't know. Anyway, never mind.
Probably. I'm not great with movies. Like, I don't remember a lot of names.
I'm terrible about it, too. Jeff has, like, this eidetic memory when it comes to things like that. I just, like, I don't know how he holds that information.
Like, it'll randomly hit me sometimes.
Yeah. He remembers, like, producers and directors and, like, I can barely remember names of the movies and some of the actors, let alone...
I remember faces, and I'll be like, oh, yeah. My God, that's so-and-so that was in this movie like 12 years ago or 20 years ago.
Oh, you know,
ago.
This so person's I use, in it, and I'm like, who's that? And he goes, you know. I probably do, yeah. But I probably don't know what his name is.
Yeah. So I use IMDb. Like, I'm regularly, like, pulling that up in shows. Mm-hmm. So
I have a bookmark on my phone.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I got the app on there. Have you heard of a new sport called quiet tennis?
Tennis? Nope. Can't say I have.
It's like normal tennis, but without the racket. What looks like half a tree? The other half.
Okay.
What do you call a deer with no eyes?
What do you call a deer with no eyes?
No idea.
Oh, I should have said that. I have no idea. Oh, no idea. Do fish go on vacation?
Do they? I don't know.
No, because they're always in school.
That's pretty good.
It's all right. What do you call a Labrador at the beach in August?
I don't know.
A hot dog. Is today really August? Or are you July-ing me? That's pretty dumb. I wanted to make it land, but I just didn't.
So... we are wrapping up season one, and I know we didn't hit every county, but we hit pretty much all of them.
Yeah, and I think the ones we missed, at a first glance, we didn't have people listed in them at the time anyway. So I think we have a few more that we added, but...
Mm-hmm. There are so many cases in Walker County. We've done a lot of posts about that, and it is hard to just, like, pick one case to cover in Walker County. So that's something that, you know, is going to have to be tabled for the next season because we have to end it at some point.
Right.
But
we'll revisit how we'll handle that.
We didn't want to end season one without talking about some recent developments that have happened.
Yeah.
You know, it not so recent is that there was the whole thing with Tony Mitchell.
Right.
The inmate who died while in custody of the sheriff's office. And just recently, actually, there was a plea agreement with one of the corrections officers, Joshua Connor Jones. And it was really interesting. And I actually have the plea agreement pulled up. His plea agreement, count one, was for the crime of conspiracy to deprivation of rights under color of law. So for that crime, the maximum punishment is imprisonment, not more than life, no more than a $250,000 fine, or both A and B, supervised release of not more than 5 years, and a special assessment fee of $100 per count. So that was the conspiracy to deprive somebody of their rights. And then there was also a charge of deprivation of rights, which had imprisonment for not more than 10 years, a fine of not more than $250,000, or both A and B, supervised release of not more than 3 years, and then also a special assessment fee of $100 per count. So two charges, and the factual basis for this plea agreement was that A, there was a deliberate indifference to Tony's medical needs. This whole thing is like, it's really sad, actually. It said, you know, each shift is staffed by several officers who are supposed to be, you know, watching over the administration of the jail. It's, right. It says the jail is headed by the sheriff, the jail administrator, the captain, and then officers who serve as shift supervisors over two different day shifts and two night shifts, along with the officers that are there to perform the various like responsibilities related to the inmate, you know, care and custody. And there are 8 booking cells, it says. Like it said, at some time, you know, there's several dorms, and then there's a limited number of inmates that are held for limited period of time for observation in the booking area. And there's apparently 8 booking cells that could be observed from the desk a few feet away.
Right.
And
the one.
One.
Yeah.
Was essentially a cement box with a grate on the floor for fluid to dry into.
Right. They call it the drunk tank.
They said it was capable of being flushed only from outside of the cell. And that it could be hosed down when, you know, people came in inebriated and maybe couldn't hold in their alcohol. And it said it was unlike the other cells in the jail, but for the observation, it's a BK5, which is that booking cell. It was unlike all other cells in the jail except for this one other one, which they refer to as AH3, which had no hole in the floor for draining fluids. And it was only used to hold detainees for a few hours. It said that booking cell 5 did not have a sink. It didn't have a toilet. It didn't have access to any running water or a raised platform to be used as a bed. Inmates that are housed in that booking cell 5 require officers to escort them to and from the shower, to and from the toilet, to bring them water. That cell is extremely cold in the winter months because you just have the bare cement floor and there's no bed, so it's even colder when you're on the floor.
Right. I mean, they're all cold anyway, but yeah.
Apparently there's a window on the top half of the cell door and then a larger window on the bottom of the door, and I think you can see this in some of the videos that have been released.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah,
these are called windows. They should be able to see into the cell, right? Because it's the desk is a few feet away. So January 12th, the sheriff's office went out to Tony's to do a welfare check. they said he was arrested after he allegedly fired a gun while the deputies were on his property. And so Joshua Jones was actually one of the officers working at the jail when Tony came in. And he was, supposedly the officers were informed that Tony was being brought in because he shot at the deputies. He was transported directly to the jail in a patrol car that was met in the jail Sallyport by correctional officers and supervisors, including Jones. And then it lists co-conspirator 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. That's 6 people.
Crazy.
That they have said conspired to deprive Tony of his rights. They removed him from the car, and at that point he could not walk or stand on his own. He was disoriented, non-combative, and could not follow instructions. Non-combative. So that means he wasn't like fighting them at all.
Right.
It said the observations were obvious to everyone who removed Tony from the car. And that Joshua Jones believed that Tony needed to be taken to the hospital or a mental health facility rather than being incarcerated at the jail. Instead, Tony was taken to the jail into a dress-out room so that he could change from his civilian clothes into the jail uniform. It said he was, quote, sufficiently helpless that he was not capable of undressing or dressing himself. After several attempts by officers to struggle with putting on a jail uniform on Tony, officers simply wrapped a suicide smock around him, known as a turtle suit, without an indication that Tony was suicidal. Instructions that he be treated as if he was suicidal, or instructions that he needed to be naked for security reasons. So because he couldn't dress himself and they were having problems trying to get him in the uniform, they just wrapped him in the smock. Because that was just easier. He was then taken by wheelchair to the medical unit, which was attended by the health services administrator, nurse 1, and nurse 2. So that sounds like 3 different medical personnel. Nurse 1 tells Joshua Jones, co-conspirator 2, 3, and 4, that she wanted to wait, I guess, about making any kind of medical decision until she received instructions from co-conspirator 1 to deny the initial fit for confinement screening. I guess I need to do some research. I don't understand what that is. Like, to deny the initial fit.
Yeah. Can you read that again?
She wanted to wait, referring to instructions from co-conspirator 1 to deny the initial fit for confinement screening.
There was something somewhere I thought I read that basically they evaluate whether they are fit for certain holding, I believe.
Gotcha. I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, was he a fit for, you know, certain housing, you know, or, you know, procedures or things like that? But like, right. What?
Or certain treatment or certain kind of, yeah. Like they could look at him and say, he mentally, he's not, should he be in medical or?
What is the confinement screening saying he's okay to be held at the jail or like, no, he's not.
But yeah.
So what are they denying? It says defendant Joshua Jones, co-conspirator 2 and 3 and co-conspirator 4. These are the ones that took him via wheelchair to the nurse to be screened. Turned the wheelchair around, left the medical unit, and put Tony into BK5. Now, Tony is referred to as individual number 1 in this plea agreement.
Right.
Then Joshua Jones and then 5 other co-conspirators.
Okay.
What they've listed. Yeah. Because they have defendant Jones, co-conspirator 1 through 5.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody, I think I read somewhere that they were like lumping him in with the 5, and I didn't think that was right, but.
They have them individually listed out. So they don't have him listed as Jones, parentheses, with quotes around, you know, they call him defendant. Because at this point, it's just him. This case is United States of America versus Joshua Connor Jones. So he is referred to as the defendant, not co-conspirator. Right. So there are five other individuals that they are considering co-conspirators.
Yeah.
So they leave the unit, the medical unit, take him and put him in booking unit five, or booking cell five, which is the unit that had no bed. It just had the hole in the floor to drain the fluids. Cement room. Small window at the top, big window at the bottom. Can only be flushed from outside the cell. The plea agreement further says that to Joshua Jones's knowledge, individual one never received any medical evaluation until the morning of his death. 2 weeks, 2 weeks after he was arrested. Jones worked seven night shifts during individual one, 2 week incarceration. And during that time, none of the officers, including Joshua Jones, made efforts to provide medical care for individual number one, nor alter the conditions of his confinement. To the contrary, Defendant Jones, co-conspirator two, co-conspirator three, and co-conspirator four, actively denied medical access to individual one, Tony Mitchell, by falsely telling medical staff that individual one was too combative to be evaluated. Now, they've already said he was non-combative and so out of it that he couldn't even change his clothes.
It just makes me so sick. The whole thing.
The plea agreement further says calling individual one combative was an excuse to mistreat him. There was no conduct that could have been committed by individual one that would have justified the denial of medical access, since the jail could manage or control any behavior that individual one might have exhibited. The capabilities of the jail to manage inmates were known and obvious to everyone who worked there, including medical staff who routinely examined and evaluated the needs of inmates who were in handcuffs or restraints of one kind or another. Moreover, individual number one was frailer than most other inmates whom Jones and his co-conspirators encountered. It said the efforts to deny individual one care persisted despite his obvious need for mental health and medical services. He was frequently expressing mental health symptoms, such as talking incoherently about demons and portals, and he was often covered in feces, which was an indication that he could not care for himself. Nearly every time Defendant Jones saw Individual One, he was on the floor and, quote, looked really bad. Defendant Jones observed Individual Number One deteriorate over the course of his incarceration. As the time passed, individual number one was almost always naked, wet, cold, and covered in feces while lying on the cement floor without a mat or blanket. By the second week of incarceration, individual number one was largely listless and mostly unresponsive to questions from officers. Nonetheless, neither Defendant Jones nor any of the co-conspirators took steps to alter the conditions in which individual one was housed, despite individual one's obvious suffering.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
The lack of regard for life that all depicts is just staggering.
I'm just going to keep reading this plea. I'm just going to keep reading the plea agreement because I think everybody needs to hear it. And
it pretty much speaks for itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It does. And you don't have to have any kind of opinion or anything because, like you said, it speaks for itself. People need to hear this because here's the thing. A lot of things like this can be avoided make yourself aware of the situations that are going on around you. Be smart when you vote. Know what's going on within your community. And it's not like this everywhere, you know.
Right.
But human lives matter, you know. And you just...
And how much has... It's
accountability.
Yeah.
That, I think that's my thing, is accountability.
And it's not like, you know, there are times where in communities where the public doesn't speak up enough for you to just have heard things about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, about something. But especially in this particular community, there has been so much said that it's almost willful ignorance in some people's parts.
Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to be better about not getting on my soapboxes.
Yeah, it's hard with us.
It is very hard. But again, like I said, I think this plea agreement is 18 pages long. So we might, you know,
a little bit of it, but yeah.
Some of it might be something that we can kind of skip through. But this part where the factual details are in there, I think it is worth reading through. So it goes on and says, despite the obviousness of individual one's need to any and all who saw him at any time during his incarceration, Defendant Jones and his co-conspirators actively chose not to provide care to individual number one. At least once during each shift, either Defendant Jones or co-conspirator 2, 3, or 4 would comment on individual one's condition, and some member of the conspiracy would dismiss individual one's needs by saying, fuck him, he gets what he gets since he shot at cops, or words to that effect. Moreover, Defendant Jones and these co-conspirators repeatedly made comments during the first few days of Individual One's detention to the effect of Individual One should have been killed because he shot at deputies rather than being brought to the jail, that they would have killed him if they were the ones responding to the welfare check, and that road deputy should have killed him rather than making the correctional officers have to deal with incarcerating him. At times, Defendant Jones and these co-conspirators spoke directly to Individual Number One, saying that he was now in their, quote, house, and that he had to deal with them, in parentheses, the officers. None of the co-conspirators, regardless of rank or seniority, objected to or discouraged the comments from continuing. To the contrary, these comments and comments like them continued amongst the officers on this and other shifts and reflected the indifference showed to Individual One's serious medical and other needs throughout his incarceration. At the beginning of his shift on January 26, 2023, around 6 a.m., co-conspirator number 5 told Defendant Jones that a nurse had seen Individual Number 1 in the early morning hours and ordered that Individual 1 be transported to a hospital, and that the transport should take place as soon as possible. The same message was conveyed by other officers to co-conspirator number 2 in the presence of Defendant Jones and others. So, this message has been told by multiple people, two different ones, that he needs to go ASAP.
I'm trying to hold my tongue.
Those officers were insistent in telling co-conspirator 2 that the nurse said individual number 1 could die if he was not taken to the hospital, to the point of repeating the message a second time to co-conspirator number 2 after co-conspirator number 2 dismissed the concerns initially expressed. In response to the second effort by those officers, co-conspirator number 2 replied, I'll tell you what, next time you're on the toilet taking a shit, I'll call you to bother you with something unimportant, or words to that effect.
Again, I'm trying to hold my tongue here.
I'm not entirely sure at this point. Did they call co-conspirator 2? I don't know, but it seems like number 2 is going to be a supervisor or some higher rank, because it sounds like he's, or she, is making the decision, like what needs to happen. Like, hey, we're relaying the message that the nurse said this is imperative. Like, this is critical. It needs to be done. So this conspirator 2 has said, I'll tell you what, next time you're on the toilet taking a shit, I'll call you to bother you with something unimportant. And I know I read that a second ago, but I just feel like it needed to be read again.
Because I have so many things I could say about that.
According to Defendant Jones, co-conspirator one and co-conspirator two. Oh, look, here we are. Both with supervisory positions at the jail. So we were right. Failed to arrange for individual one to be transported to the hospital for more than 3 hours after officers reported the nurse's instructions and the urgent need to do so.
Deep breath.
After Defendant Jones transported several detainees to court that morning, he was instructed to join other officers at Walker Baptist Medical Center, where individual one had been transported by fellow officers in the back of the patrol car rather than by ambulance. Upon arrival, he learned that individual one's mother had been called to the emergency room and overheard her giving permission to medical staff to remove individual one from life support. Defendant Jones admitted that, quote, collectively, we did it. We killed him. Factual basis letter B, the assault of individual number two. On September 26, 2022, individual number two, okay, this is a different individual.
Yeah, which I was like, oh, Tony Mitchell, but then it wasn't just Tony Mitchell.
Nope. Individual two was a pretrial detainee held in a dorm of the jail. Defendant Jones and Officer A were working as correctional officers on one of the day shifts. As part of their duties, they were moving an inmate from D dorm into A dorm. Despite the availability of other housing, Officer A insisted on placing, I think it should say, like, they were moving an inmate from the D dorm into the A dorm, and I guess there was other housing, and so they, instead of placing that inmate, they insisted on placing that inmate in a cell with individual number two and two other inmates, which caused the cell to be overcrowded, or unnecessarily crowded is actually the words that are used. Mm-hmm. When individual number two complained, Officer A purposely antagonized individual two by yelling at him and placing him against a wall in the cell and striking him without cause. At the time, individual number two was argumentative, but was posing no threat to either Defendant Jones, Officer A, or the other inmates. In response to individual number two's arguing, and to support Officer A's antagonism toward individual number two, Defendant Jones struck individual number two in the face 3 times with a can of OC spray that he carried with him. At the time, no force was necessary to manage individual number two or any other inmate, and striking individual two in the face 3 times with a metal can was unjustified. The lever or trigger on the can broke with the force of the blows, and OC spray was dispersed throughout the cell, irritating individual two, the other inmates, Defendant Jones, and Officer A, and required decontamination of all involved. Well, that sounds like it didn't go as planned.
It does sound like that, yes.
Thereafter, Defendant Jones and Officer A wrote identical false reports designed to cover up Officer A's unnecessary provocation and Defendant Jones' unnecessary use of force. The reports falsely indicated that individual number two advanced on Officer A in a way that justified using force against him. The individual number two attempted to strike Officer A such that force would have been justified to subdue individual number two, and that Defendant Jones blocked individual number two's intended attack on Officer A with his OC canister, thereby damaging the canister and causing the OC dispersal.
And just as a little side note, most of you probably understand what this is, but OC is basically pepper spray. So.
Each of these allegations was untrue and was written to hide the unjustified use of force against individual number two. Denson, the defendant hereby stipulates that the facts stated above are substantially correct and that the court can use these facts in calculating the defendant's sentence. The defendant further acknowledges that these facts do not constitute all the evidence of each and every act that the defendant and or any co-conspirators may have committed.
And that's pretty standard, don't you think? I've heard so many of these read for some of the large cases that are out there now that they don't list everything. So,
oh, well, if that probably would have taken more than 18 pages.
Yeah, probably twice that.
So there are more pages that just have, you know, general language about the agreement and how that works. And those are the pages that cover like the actual factual basis for the plea agreement. It's on Pacer. And actually, if you head over to Secrets True Crime Podcast, they've actually pulled it and posted it. And you can read it there. A lot of people know about the situation with Tony Mitchell, so they know the details and are able to identify him, even if he hasn't been identified within this document. And I'm sure actually they probably know individual number two.
Yeah, I think it's actually been stated somewhere now, but I don't know where.
But to make this a little more brazen, I guess, there's a group on Facebook called the Justice for Tony Mitchell group, I guess. And so one of the women, Casey Brown, was working as a recovery specialist at Recovery Resource Center starting in 2021, but was fired in May. And in her lawsuit against the sheriff and the sheriff's office employees, she says she was fired from her job after her bosses were pressured about her advocating for better treatment of inmates at the jail. She claims that her boss received texts and calls from the sheriff's department employees warning that her social media posts about the jail, the in-custody death of Tony Mitchell, and her advocacy for the inmates could threaten the recovery center's relationship with the sheriff's office. The lawsuit claims that after Casey Brown was fired, the jail administrator, Justin White, and another Walker County SO employee went into the jail, gathered the female inmates, and told them they should not trust her, and then blocked the inmates from making calls to her. So, that's also out there pending.
Yeah.
So that's going to be something to watch over the next little while, because obviously if they know, they already have that plea agreement with Joshua Jones, and they've listed five co-conspirators, guarantee you they know who they are.
Right.
And that'll be something coming out eventually.
There was also a lawsuit settlement involving a deputy shooting of an unarmed man who was mentally ill. The lawsuit was dismissed in June, but it just was, the article was just this month. A deputy was called to the home on Cook Creek in Empire, and the responding deputy didn't want to wait for the backup. So he apparently, that the mentally ill man was not armed. He was only wearing a bathrobe at the time that the deputy cuffed him. And according to the court filing, Johnson then shot him in the chest with no threat being posed. The shooting was recorded on video by the father of the man that was shot. And so there was a lawsuit that came to the sheriff's office against, I don't know if it's against, I'm assuming it's against the deputy and Sheriff Smith, that was settled out of court. They don't say what the settlement details are. But that is very recent too, so they've got a lot coming down on them.
There is a lot going on. That is definitely one to keep an eye on to see, like, because I think it is gonna set the tone, I think, for other counties.
Yeah.
And it is definitely something that we will be keeping an eye on, because I'm really interested to see what happens with it.
Ditto. That is for sure.
But I think it is incredibly important to hold people accountable for their own actions.
Yeah.
And it is, that's why I like the law so much, because the legal arena is the one place where you can be held accountable for your actions, especially people who think that they don't have to be. It's not always black and white. I mean, you can find things to support any opinion that you have, really. I mean, there's going to be something out there to argue any way you need to go. But the United States is like the only place where you get a jury of your peers that get to sit and listen to all of the evidence and make a decision. And it's something that is really kind of a phenomenal thing. It doesn't matter how complex the case is. When you have all these people come in and they hear all this evidence, and it can be so complicated or it can be not complicated at all. It can be super cut and dry.
Yeah.
But they get it right a lot of the time. And it doesn't matter what their experience or their background is. It's just this kind of concerted effort and teamwork, really. But they don't do that everywhere. It's here.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know. It's just so, it's important. And I don't know. That's why I like just the law in general, the legal field. And it is slow moving for sure.
That's the frustrating part. Yeah.
Yes. But boy, do I love to see when it starts rolling.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving down south.
Yeah.
There were some remains found.
Yeah. Very interesting. Anxious yeah. to hear more about this one.
Skull and some bones. I don't think they're very specific about it. Were found in Mount Vernon off of East Coy Smith Highway and Shepherd House Road, like kind of where, if you look on the map, Shepherd House runs into Coy Smith.
Mm-hmm. Just a little off that. Yep.
So a man named David Weaver was walking into the woods and discovered the skull. There are a few, you know, we sent the sheriff's office a list of people, you know, that we have in the area for, you know, possible comparisons. Mm-hmm. And so there haven't been any updates there at, you know, since they were found. I think the last update that I saw actually was on Fox 10 a few days ago. So maybe that's something they can, you know, they'll be updating on. But speaking of Mobile County Sheriff's Office, here's a little teaser for next season. We will be working with them to cover the Stephen Pearson case in season 2.
So happy we were going to be doing that. That's a very interesting case.
Stephen went missing at the end of 2000, beginning of 2001. And I'm super excited to be working with Sheriff Burt and the Mobile County Sheriff's Office on it and having them on the show.
Yeah, so, I can't wait to get them in here and have you all meet them.
And in the meantime, while we're working on that and getting ready for it, if anybody has any information about Stephen's case, he was last seen, as far as anybody knows, in the Grand Bay area. And anybody who might have seen him or might have heard anything, get it to us. Send it in. Or send it over to the sheriff's office. But, you know, you can always send it in. You can send it to info@alcoldcase.com and let us check it out while we're getting everything ready for the next season.
We have a case card that we posted on social media. I cannot say social media. has a few little bits of information that might help you, you know, help ring bells for you.
Yep.
So yeah, please send those tips.
And I think we've actually talked about his case a little bit. So
we did. I can't remember.
It's really interesting to me because he was, you know, off work for the holidays, and he was helping kind of like a temporary seasonal postal worker. So he signed for a package or received a package for a neighbor, attempting to help, you know, they had the addresses mixed up, sticks it over in the neighbor's you know, over by their house or back porch while they were out of town, and then finds out later that it actually had, like, I don't know, 15 to 20 pounds or something of marijuana in it. And goes and reports it after he finds that out, reports it to the Postal Service, like, this package that I signed for had this in it. I didn't know. And so that's the last anybody really knows. He went missing shortly after that.
Yep.
And then his car was found later, months later. And, you know, there were references to it looking like it may have been staged.
Right. Yeah. We did talk about that. It was in the December minisode last year. So
I think it's going to be really interesting. Oh, also, if anybody's interested, there's a show on the Weather Channel called Storm of Suspicion. And they actually covered a Mobile County case. And it's actually one of Sheriff Birch's case. And one of our favorite investigators, Mitch McCray, when they worked homicide together. It is the case of Jeremy Jones. He murdered Lisa Nichols in September of 2004. Well, he was found guilty in September of 2004 of murdering Lisa Nichols. Oh, and wow. So that the show, when I found it on Weather Channel, I was like, this is such an odd channel for this to be on. But they cover crimes that occur during storms, and it happened during a hurricane.
Yeah.
And, but that Jeremy Jones is an interesting fellow because he went by a totally different name and had fingerprints under his other name. And it's really interesting, like how this actually, they had him in the system under this name in like Georgia, but then they got a call from another state saying that's not the right person that you've got. So it's something, it's like I said, it just came out actually, I think a few months ago, like it's a more recent show that they released.
Well,
anybody who hadn't watched it, but is interested.
So John, it's just, is it John Paul Chapman?
That's what they thought his name was.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Yep. Gotcha. I'm going to have to watch it.
Yeah. I'll have to look and see what the name is again. We can link it in the episode details. So since you guys have probably already noticed, it's a little bit different this week. We didn't have a preview for a case and at the beginning of the episode or anything like that. And we've done the Unforgotten Talks in the past, of course, but you know, this is a little bit of a milestone. And it's a little bit sad being that it's the end of season one.
That's so crazy. It makes me feel like it's so cool. We had a season one and we're going to have a season two.
I mean, to be fair,
that means
like
we've made it, right?
It was a really long season one.
Yep, it was a really long season
one. Like abnormally long. But you know, for two people that are like managing this whole thing by ourselves, it's not terrible.
Yeah. And so, this isn't just the only thing we do. So,
nope, true story.
Yeah.
And, but it's been just a really great year and a half, you know.
It really has.
But sharing the cases and the topics that are so important to me and you and all of the listeners. And it just, really, the support has been overwhelming.
It has. We've made so many friends through the ACCA and the Unforgotten podcast. I mean, this, the whole thing.
Yes.
We've rebuilt relationships with law enforcement and fellow content, you know, creators and advocates, and just so many compassionate people. It's just been overwhelming, actually.
Yes, the network has like expanded tenfold for sure.
It really has, and we've really folded, I don't know, 100 plus of the most important people in all of this, and the reason for our mission, the families. They become our family.
Exactly.
As we say very often, but it's true. You know, we may not talk to every single one of them all the time, but we do try to check in periodically. And we, you know, have been partnering with a few of them even recently, you know, occasionally. So that's kind of that's a special relationship because they're not only being helped a bit by us, but they're helping us too.
Yeah, we have Doc's Angel Hearts.
Yeah.
And, you know, anybody who makes a donation through the website, we send out one of Doc's Angel Heart jewelry pieces to you and that as a thank you. And we've had Dr. Holly join us as a board member in our ACCA nonprofit. George James' mom, Tillis, she's writing the Breaking the Silence blog series on the website. And she actually, the first case that she was kind of taking a look at was the Rakeem Samuel case. And that's up posted. I actually need to go share that on the social media page because it's already published and it's up. So we need to get that shared. But it has been just great. I mean, it's been a complete blessing to meet these wonderful people who have allowed us into their world and trusted us. And sometimes I feel like have way more faith in us than what we even have with helping navigate through the worst parts of their lives. And in 43 episodes, which might actually be more like 51 since there were a couple that have more than one.
Yeah.
They've let us share some of that sorrow and anger and hope and fight with you guys. They have been just outstanding resources and support for us and others, despite their need of support for their loved ones. And that always is amazing to me, how even going through all this, sometimes some of the best things are most empowering things for them is to be able to help somebody else navigate through it and use their experiences to help somebody else, you know?
Yeah. Yep. A therapy of sorts, maybe even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we of course have been fortunate to have all of you join us by listening, and not just listening. You share the episodes and the posts we've made on social media. You just have no idea how much it means to all of us, and especially to the families, that people are, paying attention and care. These families who have gone years with no attention to their family member's case, and we've even seen movement. Mm-hmm. And we've even seen movement in a couple of cases. So
we have. Mm-hmm. It's just a remarkable thing. And I think that's probably been one of the most amazing things to watch with the social media pages. Because you see, we've talked about this before, and we've talked about it with the our podcast support group that we're in with other creators, that you really see kind of the worst of humanity sometimes in social media with just these keyboard warriors and things. Their cyberbullying is a thing now, and people are just mean. People are just mean. And it has been just one of the most remarkable things to see this grow like it has, but also see the support, the best of humanity come together for this.
We may see the worst, but we do see the best too. Yeah.
We've had minimal problems or issues with it. Yeah. It has, for the greater part of it, been very positive and uplifting. And it is just, it's something that we need because it encourages us to keep going, but it is great for the families to have that because it makes them feel a little less alone.
Yeah.
At least
it's, and it kind of makes us feel a little less alone too. You know, you never really know when you go into start something like this. You know, we know that we're in it because we think these families need the exposure and they need the help and, you know, that all of that. You never really know really what you're going to, how it's going to be taken and what kind of an effect you're going to have. In fact, you know, like we have always said, when we first started this, we figured we'd have, maybe at the most a few hundred people paying attention to any of the things that we're doing. And, here we are, well over 20,000 Facebook followers and
growing.
Just growing every day. It's just been amazing.
And I will go ahead and apologize because I have not been as active on our social media pages as what I was. We've mentioned it in one of the previous episodes that I have returned back to the office. So I'm on a little bit different of a schedule, but also trying to get the foundational structure of the nonprofit going has been a little more detailed.
A lot more detailed than what we really even thought. It's
like start it and go. It kind of like the podcast, actually. Yeah. You don't just like decide you're going to do it and then boom, it's done. Be nice if it came like a bed in a bag. It doesn't. Everything you need does not come in a box. So that has taken up a good bit of time. We're working on the fundraiser, which has been pushed to the spring because, again, there are some foundational things that we need to get well established. Yeah. So that's taken up a lot of time because we want to make sure that we are giving the families and law enforcement the best access to resources and our, you know, best efforts. So right now it feels like we're a little bit of a lot of stuff.
Right.
And so we get spread a little bit thin. So one of the things that we're doing is we're working on getting an intern. We've had a couple of interviews. And so that will be helpful, I think. So if you have seen a delay in responses to your messages, we apologize. Right. It won't always be this way.
And, you know, we've tried to, the ones that we've gotten, we've tried to make at least a response, even if it has been delayed. We'll try to make sure that you always know at least we saw your message, even if we can't get to it right away as far as what are you asking. But.
And I'm still working on the shirt. I got a little sidetracked.
It'll come soon. Soon.
We have a good base on it. Kit Arbor over at J.O. Akery and her graphic designer came up with a phenomenal graphic design, and we are just tweaking it a little bit. And so, of course, it always ends up being a little bit more detailed than what we expected it to be. So just a little bit of work left on that, and then we'll have something up for you guys to see. But it is going to be great.
We always go the hard way, don't we?
It never feels like it's going to be that way, though. It always seems like...
I know. That's all right, though.
Turns out that it is.
We care, right?
Everything ends up... You think it's going to be 10 times easier than what it is. It's not.
Yeah.
It's always a little bit more work than what you think it is. But, I mean, what is that saying about why nothing worth having is easy or something?
Yeah, something
like that. I mean, good things take work or effort. I don't know. There's something like that.
Good things come to those who wait. I don't know. One of those.
Story mentioned that we've seen movement in a couple of cases. And we had little to do with these cases being solved. But we were fortunate enough to see the answers for Aaron Toole being located, Monica and Dalton Rollins having an arrest, and that is currently, you know, prosecution's pending. And then there was also that identification of Amore Javea Wiggins,
which was fantastic,
who was formerly the Opelika Baby Jane Doe. And then there was also the recent arrest of Brittany Robinson's father in relation to her nobody homicide case. Disappointingly on that one, they have released him on bond, but he is supposed to be wearing a monitor, electronic monitoring. So we're also excited to be working on a few other cases in the background that hopefully one day we'll be able to share with you guys. We're obviously still very much working on Mont's case.
And George's.
And
CJ's.
We could go on.
Yeah. I know. We could go on.
So if you go back and you listen and you think, oh, wait, do remember this. And I don't think I ever told anybody. Or... I may have told somebody the wrong information, but now I want to tell them the right information. Or I know somebody that has information.
Right.
Anything, really. So you can email
go
us.
Back and re-listen to the episodes if you you know, this right now is a great time to re-binge.
Yes, we are going to be on break until January. And you can email us at info@alcoldcase.com or stormy@alcoldcase.com or sellers@alcoldcase.com because we now have emails.
Yay.
Yay. Took some work to get that done.
Yeah.
I'm learning the techie stuff.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I still don't know exactly how you did it, but that's great.
I don't know exactly how I did it. But it's done now.
But, yep, yep. And, you know, you don't have to go cold turkey. We aren't going to go cold turkey. We'll probably, you know, be putting out little bits here and there. We can't keep quiet, you know, us. We have to say, we have to share once in a while. And we'll be on social media. And when we get an intern, they'll probably be on social media. Not say social media. Social media also.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not going to quit sharing. We're just not going to have new episodes out for our new season out for.
We might try to like do like interviews or something. We're just, we got to focus on getting the nonprofit stuff done.
Yeah. Yeah. If something big comes up, an update or something, we won't wait. Yeah.
Although we might make the intern come in and do an episode.
Yeah. That would be kind of
be great. Yeah. That would be.
We don't know.
Who knows? But the plan right now is January.
Yeah.
For the actual like case research specific episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll be busy, busy bees in the background. But we want to thank you all again for your support. And I guess we'll see you officially in 2025.
Oof, that sounds weird. This year's flown by.
I know. It's August. I mean,
or July.
Oh my gosh. All right. See you guys.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Spotify for Podcasters, available on your favorite podcast platform. Intro music for the show was created by Principles of Uncertainty, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Content and production is by Sellers and Stormy, artwork by Sellers. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and any source referenced in our podcast can be found in each episode's description. We hope you will join us on all the major social media sites and continue to raise awareness of our Alabama cold cases. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
Oh, you've been recording for a while.
Oh, no, I literally just like hit the thing a second ago.
It says 3 minutes and 28 seconds.
Damn, I didn't think it was that long.
Okay.
It's cool.
Did I do that? Oh, I wasn't even looking when I was reading the article while I was typing. It's funny. It's cool. It's a new word.
is there an echo in here? My son and I do this thing where we're like, oh my God, how tall do you think they are? And so we like to look up heights. It's weird. It's a weird thing, really? But that's what we do.
It's like, really strange, like, hobby,
oh
guys.
Oh my God, that dude looks like huge. Or like, whoa, he's really short, or she's really tall, or whatever. Like, Brienne of Tarth on Game of Thrones. It's like,
super oh my cool. God, she's like Amazon.
Imperative. Like, this is critical. It needs to be done. Can you hear that dang cat?
I heard something, but I didn't know what it was.
Do you hear it?
Yeah, no, I hear. Meow, meow. Meow.
Oh my God. Did they have relayed this to somebody who has said, but it's been quiet this whole time? No, don't you come running in here like climbing on the damn curtains again. Immediately, straight out here into the curtains. How does NASA plan a party? Damn it, that was messed up. How does NASA organize a party?
You did it wrong. How does NASA how?
They plan it. Okay. I was like, oh, damn, I used the wrong word.
Yeah, that would really screw things up right there.
I gave it away.
Oh my gosh.
What do you call cheese that isn't yours?
I keep trying to think of the answers.
Nacho cheese.
Oh, yeah, I have heard that before. What does the sun drink out of?
I don't know.
Sunglasses. One more. What did the pig say at the beach on a hot summer day?
I'm bacon.
Yep. That goes along with nacho cheese, I think. Oh my gosh.
I like that one.
That one wasn't too bad.
Ender. That sounds ominous.
I might take Ender off of there. Like, season one. There we go. Season one. Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.